runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 221 with guests Paul Randall and Kim Tripp. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. You're listening to Run As Radio. I am in the home of Paul Randall and Kim Tripp, having spent a wonderful evening, and we're up early in the morning. The sun is shining. It was a great evening. We had a good time. And we decided we'd sit down and chat. We also have a special guest with us as well, Kira. And she'll make her contributions to the show as things go along, because we want to talk a little bit about fixing database performance problems. So you guys do this kind of work all the time, right?
Yeah.
It's still really early.
Yeah. He forgot to mention that it's, what, 7 a.m.?
we've all been up for a while, and we've got our appropriate caffeinated beverages.
The sun is shining. We have coffee.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. And this is the conversation we tend to have anyway.
So I know.
I thought we might as well capture it.
Yeah. I would say that probably perf tuning is 95% of the consulting work that we end up doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'd also say the thing that's funny about it is, high availability disaster recovery just isn't sexy. And
it really isn't.
No, and people think, you know.
Yes, it is.
Well, no, but it isn't sexy as far as, you know, training. People aren't as interested in high availability disaster recovery. They want to take performance tuning, classes and seminars.
That is very
true. And it's really interesting because it, you know, high availability disaster recovery is way more important than performance tuning, but people don't know they need it until they need it.
Yeah, it's going to be absolutely fine. If you don't have a backup, you're screwed.
Yeah, it's suddenly all over. That's a different kind of performance problem where you go from 100
exactly.
miles an hour
to zero.
There's no way back.
That's not good.
Yeah. So I got to imagine the email you get is, my database is too slow.
Help!
Yeah,
help!
Please save me. Can you fix it by tomorrow? Where's the big red button to go fast?
Yeah, a lot of people kind of hit a wall.
Yeah.
You know, that things are running okay, but then maybe they get slower and slower over time. I mean, well, there's different types of walls they hit. Sometimes it's things get slower and slower over time, and sometimes it's everything was running fine.
And we fell off this cliff.
And we fell off a cliff.
Right.
So depending on, and those are the people that are like, help, our system is down, you know, almost effectively down.
Yeah.
And they're almost in a panic state. So yeah, it you know, it's a big, it depends on kind of what people ask us for, but kind of how we go about
it. Wow, that was like 2 minutes, 30 seconds to the first, it depends.
Yeah, like, we should keep a running list of, you know, each class it took.
Yeah, please send me an email, info@runasradio, and tally how many times we'll say, it depends, by the end of this show. Because we're all wearing our consultants' hats today, because that is the job we're
and
in.
Our robes.
And our robes. Yeah, and our robes. Some of us are more dressed than others, but I wasn't going to go into those kind of details. You'll notice there'll be no photos from this
show.
No
photos.
So what's your favorite starting point? You know, now you've decided to take on this customer and you're in front of their RDP session. What do you open first?
It's funny because I my approach to performance tuning is going to be different than Paul's approach, which is going to be different than Jonathan's approach.
Mm-hmm.
So, whatever we're kind of being called in on is the angle that we'll take. And so I first tend to look for whether or not indexes are, you know, dead weight, aren't getting used. And I end up kind of dropping those because they take so much overhead. Insert, update, delete performance, mm-hmm. as you mentioned. They take cache space, so they waste cache.
So an index that's not being used will still end up in cache?
Well, it ends up in cache because anytime there's a modification, that
right.
modification has to go through all of the indexes whether they're
course.
Getting used, you know, efficiently or for seeks or scans. So there's different aspects of an index's usage patterns,
mm-hmm.
right? It could be used efficiently to look up data through seeks and scans. Or it could be used solely for basically overhead and updates.
How do you figure out that an index is just not being used? This is not a profiler thing, right? It's a DMV thing?
It's a DMV thing,
okay.
Yeah. So there's a specific DMV called DMDB Index Usage Stats, and there's underscores between all of those.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with it is that anytime you bounce the server, anytime you detach and attach, which I can't imagine people are doing
very
often.
Don't do that too often.
No, yeah, that's not really
good.
A regular operation. But anytime that database kind of gets disconnected, those stats are lost.
Right.
So if your server was bounced over the weekend, let's say, and it's Tuesday and you say, hey, I'm going to look at the index usage stats, there might be a tremendous number of indexes that aren't getting used.
Right.
And so you want to be really careful. But that's, if I look at the server and I find that the server was restarted, you know, we had a customer a couple of weeks ago, their server had been restarted in November. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and it was at the time, it was end of May.
So it was running for months.
Months and months. And we ended up analyzing all of their usage stats in one of their databases. And I won't name names. It was a third party product, but, we ended up analyzing their index usage patterns, and they had, I think it was 367 indexes that had not been seeked or scanned more than five times in seven months.
Yeah.
Yeah. And had over, what was it, 50,000 updates?
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
367 indexes. And so that just adds a tremendous amount of overhead and unnecessary, well, overhead. I mean, and just cost to everything you do. And so dropping those and removing those is great. It was a, well, go ahead. I know what you're going to say, but
one of the things that people often do though, which is wrong, is look at those stats, and if they see an index that's not been used, they just drop it straight away.
Right.
Without considering the entire business life cycle and whether the index is necessary for an end of month report
or a CEO report. Maybe it's
like
a year end report. It doesn't get used very often, but
exactly.
Even if it was only being used that rarely, isn't it worth building the index for that usage and dumping it
that's
again?
That's exactly right.
Sometimes.
So
interesting.
Disable
point.
The index or just even drop the index and just rebuild it just when it's used.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now the other thing to consider though is there could be indexes that look like they're not being used, but they're enforcing a uniqueness constraint. And the very fact that the index exists can help the query optimizer while it's actually running a query.
Here's an interesting problem. So it's not going to show up in usage stats, but it's actually important to query planning.
Right. So
I got to admit, the past 10 years of SQL Server, I've gotten used to the fact that the query optimizer is a bloody genius. It's smarter than me, and it builds better query plans.
Everybody on the query optimizer team has a PhD in some little tiny area of query performance.
And they're crazy smart. And,
yeah,
and
exactly.
When I, you know, the funny part is then I go play with other people's databases and get back to the old day where how I wrote the query changed the way the plan got optimized. Because I feel like SQL Server just doesn't do that anymore. I can write the query three different ways and get the same bloody plan.
And generally, I would totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
There are some cases, though, that SQL Server sees something a certain way in a certain type of query plan, like a join or a subquery, that it doesn't see the other way. So I have taken existence tests, or joins and rewritten them as existence tests or in writing them as existence tests. And sometimes the rewrite does actually help in fairly complicated queries. Simple queries, I would argue, no, it generally doesn't, but the more really complicated. But you're right. Over the last 10 years, I mean, there was a tool, and I don't know the name of it, but it was way back when with Oracle that literally was tens of thousands of dollars, and its sole purpose was to rewrite your queries as many ways possible to give you the one that Oracle optimized the best, because at the time Oracle did syntactical optimization.
It's called a Kimberly in a box.
No.
I think I saw that music video.
Okay, anyway. So that was, I mean, this is, I think this was 15 or 20 years ago, way before my time, I'd like to say. But anyway,
how old are you?
So anyway, I said, how many times am I going to say anyway in this? But its sole purpose was literally to rewrite the query to give you the one that was the best.
Right.
Days like that are long gone. And that's the good news, you know, is that we don't have to rewrite a query 18 different ways and write joins in every single possible combination and order to get the optimizer to do a better job.
Yeah.
You're right. These guys are freaking brilliant. I mean, it's awesome. So that makes life good, but it also makes things a little bit hard sometimes to understand, because sometimes the plans they come up with, you look at and you're kind of like,
how'd you get there?
Exactly. And there are some cases, and you've got to realize that since SQL is a general purpose database engine, it can get any query at any time of any combination of anything, right? And so sometimes it doesn't do the right job, you know, and there are cases where people will end up with weird query plans. And so, you know, very rarely, but sometimes we might have to force something, or we might have to use a derive table. Like that, that's one of my favorite forms of a hint is, mm-hmm. is to actually take multiple tables in a subquery within your larger query. If there's, let's say, three or four tables that when joined yield a very small set, putting them in a subquery within the from clause, it's called a derive table, but a lot of people don't know that that's right. what it's called, can actually be the best form of a hint because it gives the optimizer a little bit more insight into that join.
What about an index view as another way to create a construct for that?
So an index view could be really beneficial. I'm hesitant to use index views for joins because you might end up materializing a lot of redundant, otherwise normalized data. Mm-hmm. So I often use index views for summarization, aggregates,
It's all about getting the query to touch the index rather than to go to the tables. You've materialized a relationship between those tables in a way that the query the when it actually executes query, it never touches the tables. It pulls that data from the view.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Because a view is normally nothing more than a name, save, select.
Right.
When you build a clustered index on a view, you're basically materializing that data. Mm-hmm. So depending on what's in that view, you could be materializing something that's very small and maybe very efficient, like an aggregate's a great example.
Yeah.
Or if it's a join, and that join is the example I always use is imagine joining employees and departments, and in that join you are exposing the department name. So you have 2,000 employees in R&D, mm-hmm. and you go to update the department name to research and development. Then SQL would have to update the departments table, but then it would have to update the indexed view and update 2,000 rows from R&D to research and development.
Yeah.
Which would be tremendously expensive. So depending on what you have materialized in that view, you can sometimes get orders of magnitude better performance, but you can also kill your performance as well.
But you're always trading
updates.
Off this
exactly.
retrieval performance to update performance, right? I mean, that is
always.
The trade.
But that one would be extreme. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. it would be, you know, one row has now gone to 2,100 rows.
Right.
You know, so that one's really extreme. So I don't tend to use indexed views for joins. I tend to use them for other things, but you could. I mean, if you don't have a lot of redundant data that's highly volatile, then that's okay. But then storing R&D 2,000 times might be very expensive. So there's a lot of trade-offs there. I love indexed views. I do tend to see that they get used sometimes the wrong way.
Right.
And then I have to kind of come in and say, you know, if we tune the join, we might not need this index view.
Right. And like you said, in a derived table, that's a way to basically create that on the fly. You're paying the price for it in the query, though.
No, because SQL Server can optimize around it and can decide not to materialize that and not to... They will join the tables in the best order that they see fit. The thing that you're doing with the derived table is effectively giving them some insight into which order might be most interesting,
mm-hmm.
but it's not a guarantee even. So unless you do something like set force order on, you're never guaranteeing the order tables in the join.
And I see so few cases where that's actually a good idea.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's usually not. It's usually
not
really, really bad.
We dove directly into the index side of optimization in general. Paul, do you run into hardware issues? Like when you're starting on these problems?
Yeah.
I found a setup where a customer was having terrible performance problems because they put the transaction log in the database on different drives, but they were mapped to the same spindles on the SAN.
Yeah.
And so performance just sucked.
One of the first things that I look at, there's two things that I look at first. One of them is what's the average IO latencies for all of the files that they have on their server?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's going to be a hotspot somewhere, potentially.
Right.
And that can often be because a query plan has changed. So all the stuff that Kimberly's talking about, something's gone wrong. And very often what I'll see is somebody's has a problem with an IO subsystem, and you can identify that from looking at the IO latencies.
Right.
But then they'll think it's the IO subsystem that's wrong.
Right.
Knee-jerk.
Yeah, blame the SAM,
blame the IO subsystem.
Are you looking via perfmon? How are you looking
at the IO subsystem? No, there's another DMV, sys.dm IO
really
virtual
close.
File stats.
He gets really close to the
IO get really. I listen down and see what's going on.
I watch the blinky lights. They
exactly,
tell me many things.
So, this DMV, sys.dm IO virtual file stats.
Right.
And you can't just look at the DMV. You have to do a little bit of aggregation to get the average IO latencies. But that will look for every single file and show you. Whereas if you look at perfmon, at the physical disk perfmon counters, that just gives you for that drive letter. So you can't dig in and see which of the files on that particular partition or learn or whatever, because you could have multiple databases sitting there, but only one of them is actually contributing to the performance issue.
Right.
But what many people do is they knee-jerk and they think, oh, it's the I/O subsystem.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of the time, it's not. It's actually something inside SQL Server that's going wrong. So for instance, it could be a query plan has changed, and so a non-clustered index isn't being used, and a table scan is being done.
Right.
So
you're creating a hotspot because it's walking this table.
You're driving more IOs than you've actually spec'd out your IO subsystem for. It's not the IO subsystem's fault. It's something else.
Yeah.
It could be that there's memory pressure. You could have a whole bunch of ad hoc query plans that are bloating your plan cache, stealing memory from the buffer pool, which means the buffer pool's smaller, so it can't hold your workload in memory, so it's thrashing the buffer pool and driving more IOs.
And immediately, yeah, pushes more IOs as the buffer pool's coming and going.
Exactly.
Constantly.
So you think it's the IO subsystem, but it's not. It's something else.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most common perf issues in terms of hardware is Windows Server 2008 ships with the balanced power mode.
Interesting.
So your CPUs aren't running at full power. So they clock
by default.
By default. So they clock down to a lower clock speed.
Because it's a server. So you should have the power settings set, not.
I mean,
Now look, we're living in a world where our job generally is to make things go as fast as possible. So of course we always dial everything to 11.
Right. I mean, you can see the argument that Microsoft probably went through, like, okay, let's dial the CPUs down by default so it saves people's power. It's green computing, right?
Right.
But for a database server where you're trying to churn through things as fast as possible, that doesn't work very well.
I just wonder how many databases we never see that are dialed that way and it's good enough.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I did a server on my blog, where I educated people about this free tool called CPU-Z.
Right.
Where you can download it and run it and you can see what your clock speeds are. And a whole bunch of people had no idea that this problem even existed. So.
And did you get any stats on how much performance they got back? When they turned it up?
I want to say tens of percent in terms of performance gain.
Sure.
The same kind of thing about, you know.
For adjusting a setting.
Right.
I mean, isn't the balanced power plant supposed to give the full CPU when the demand is there?
Ah, yes. But how far do you actually have to crank up your workload to get the CPU to switch to the higher mode?
Interesting.
Yeah. You've got to be burning through sometimes 60 to 70% CPU before it will clock up.
Yeah.
Okay, which kind of sucks. Now, the other thing that that can be a problem is, you know, you get on a system and they don't have a DBA, involuntary DBA, very, very common. And we've seen large corporations with mission critical systems where there's no DBA, which is, you know, horrendous. And that could be kind of maintenance plans where they're doing things like shrink.
Hey, Kira, Kira.
We'll do that again.
Let's do the SAG.
No, I was going to say it differently. I was gonna.
What's your setup?
My setup was gonna be, and one of the things that can be really problematic are database options, and then point to care.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. I won't step on this. Go ahead.
All right. So, these DBAs, they could have maintenance plans that are poorly set up. They've got shrink in there. They've got rebuilds happening every night.
And they could even have database options that are set up incorrectly and not configured. In fact,
and I always say auto shrink is just evil.
Those are words of wisdom from a very wise 9-year-old.
Yes. There's some much older people that need to take that information in.
Absolutely. I wish they would. Yeah.
That never found a case where auto shrink was a good idea.
Never, never. So every question about SQL Server, we always joke when we're teaching a class, the answer starts with, it depends. And then, you explain why. Yeah. Except, should I have auto shrink enabled?
Yeah.
Categorically, no.
Never.
Yeah. In fact, when I used to own the storage engine, I tried to remove auto shrink, and I was not allowed to remove it because it had to be there for backwards compatibility. Can you believe that?
Yes, we made a mistake and we can't undo the mistake.
We've given people loaded guns in the past. We've got to continue to do so. Here you go. Have a nice day.
Can we at least, make it black on black so they can't see the option to turn it on?
Yeah, I know.
Or put big signs around it. Don't do it.
Red flashing warning light. Well, it's like the fact that the default recovery model is the full recovery model.
Right.
So, and as soon as you take a full backup, it switches the database into the, you must now take log backups or your log will grow forever and run out of space mode. But does it give you flashing warning red lights and stuff? No.
People found that out when their logs fill the drive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I don't have a problem with default full recovery mode. I just think people don't know the implications of
it. That's the key. Education is the key.
It is the most effective recovery model as well. I mean, it's fully functional, fully optional, fully recoverable. Mm-hmm. I mean, full has a lot of meaning behind it as well, although I'm not sure full was maybe the best name for it. But it is the right place, but they put him into a, I'll give you the history on this. In 6.5, basically the default be, I know, 6.5. I know. I knew I was waiting for you to say that. But if you go back in time in 6.5, I'm trying to actually now think back because I know this was one of the major problems.
Your memory goes when you start to
way back when, the default recovery model used to be that they would, oh God, I can't even remember now. They made this change so that the full recovery model didn't cause the log to grow until you did a full backup.
Right.
Because it was a problem prior where it was just growing and growing and growing. But what's funnier is all they did was kind of push off the problem so people wouldn't notice it. In their entire dev cycle, they finally do a full backup because, well, that's a good idea.
As soon as it goes to production.
Yeah, as soon as it goes to production or as soon as they really have something they want to start.
Or somebody says, oh, we haven't done a backup of this database. Let's do one.
Exactly. And so they finally do that. And then they're not even thinking about the problem. They've never seen the problem. And then all of a sudden they have potentially a huge problem
off
in production.
The logs go. You must have met databases that didn't require full recovery, though.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, development environments, environments where you're staging data, environments where you might have mostly a data warehouse. Mm-hmm. And
that you can recreate.
The main thing is that there's another source of the data somewhere.
Exactly.
If everything we're getting for these tables is coming from another automatable source, right, we're populating from a Kix file or something along those lines, I don't need the recovery model on and I can get rid of the transaction log. But as soon as I'm creating original data of any kind, I want it backed up, really backed up, and I want the logs available so that I can recover it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that gives you the ability to do regular, automated, consistent log backups. I mean, simple, what's interesting about simple is you still can't completely remove the log and you still don't get rid of login, but you don't have to keep the log around. So the likelihood of the log growing extremely large is lower mm-hmm. because they won't keep transactions after they've completed. And I'm really oversimplifying how it works. But if you have a single really large update, that could take a lot of log space. So people still have issues where the transaction log grows quite a bit in simple, even if they're not really keeping it around for very long. So it's one of these weird things that people have to be aware of. They think going to simple turns off logging, but it doesn't.
If you are listening out there and you do have this problem where your log's going out of control, even if you're in simple, there's a query you can run, which is select log underscore reuse underscore wait underscore desk from sys.databases, and SQL Server will tell you why your log is growing. In other words, why the log can't clear. And it'll say something like active tran or replication or something like that, which says, go do something about that. So you can figure out why your log is growing out of control.
You can collapse a transaction that's been hung up and is blocking the log.
You can figure out, you can figure out which connection it is and go kill the connection, for instance. Yep.
And
Killstid, one of my favorite commands.
Yep.
It sounds like most of these things aren't, I mean, terribly technical per se. There are places to look.
Yeah,
and places
Paul's
to
not very
things.
Smart. That's definitely
that's very true.
But it's just a lack of education. Folks don't know.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because I did a blog post yesterday called Ignorance is Not Stupidity.
Right.
Because, you know, I see so many times on the internet forums and so on where somebody will ask a question and get shot down or get railed on or, oh my God, how can you not know that kind of thing? Where the implication is the fact that they don't know means that they're stupid in some way, which is not true because everybody, including Kimberly and I, starts with absolutely zero knowledge about SQL Server.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just whether you have time to learn, what you have time to learn about, and so on.
I mean, think about it. Kira even knows that auto shrink should be off.
And she's only 9.
I think the bigger issue here is certain members of our community can get into a behavior that suppresses the willingness of others to learn.
Exactly.
That's what really worries me is always be willing to let other folks learn to try and get some more experience.
Yeah. Okay. So I can play both sides of this one. Mm-hmm. Some folks get kind of frustrated by the fact that there are folks that get on these forums and they basically say, how do you spell select? Yeah. And you get, so over the years, I mean, if I go way back in time.
But it could be that they don't know to go and look on Google. They don't know about books online.
Sure. I'll give you that. I do find it frustrating sometimes. And I definitely don't do this, but way back when I do remember, you know, kind of criticizing somebody. This is literally like 20 years ago myself, mm-hmm. where I had criticized somebody for asking kind of this question because they had asked about 15 questions. And it was clear after 13, 14 of them that they weren't looking at the books online. And it was like, okay, you have now sent 15 emails to hundreds of people. and you haven't looked at the books online. So there's two sides to this, right? I think a lot of it is people get frustrated. The books online are actually hard to sometimes decipher and find what you're interested in. They're so voluminous.
They feel like reference material. They are not start here, go here.
No, that's
do
the
that.
Worst part. Yeah. So
they are working on changing that.
Yeah. So let me get back to this. I think we have to be very supportive, and that's always my goal. But I do find too that there are some folks that just don't even take the initiative. They don't even hit Google. They don't, I mean, it's like very frustrating when somebody puts a question that literally the first hit on Google is exactly what is their answer.
Right.
So I wish that people were taking a little bit more time, but I can play devil's advocate to that as well. That there's
exactly,
and how do they know what to search for, or how do they know that the person that they hit or the blog post they find is actually trustworthy?
Especially your blog.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess I can keep running circles around all of this, but it is true that we need to try to be as supportive as possible and really help folks.
Can't we all just get along?
Nice. But the goal here is to create more people educated about how to use SQL Server.
Should we start singing, "We are the world"?
There'll be no singing. Nothing good can come of that.
No, nothing good. Especially at 7:30 in the morning.
Guys, other places folks should be looking besides your blog for, you know, I'm in trouble with my database. Where do I get started?
Well, I would say that they should Google it, Bing it, whatever. Mm-hmm. And try to find at least one or two sources, right, you know, that have the, so, and then of course, I would say above all, go onto a test environment, test it first.
Right.
And, you know, don't test it in production almost no matter who they get the information from. I mean, even Paul and I, we don't necessarily test every single thing we've ever run on every service pack, hot fix, upgraded version.
Behavior changes.
And that it's really important that people take the time to kind of test it on the version that they're running on. And I mean, these things sound like common sense, but sometimes under pressure, whatever the case is, people make bad choices.
Yeah.
So it's one of these things that you're always better off to spend a little bit more time to really figure it out. Double check it with maybe two blogs or, you know, go to the books online after you find a few things and read up and see if there's anything in the notes section. Cause after syntax, there's a section. It's either notes or special considerations or requirements.
Remarks.
There's a remarks section. And I usually just skim through that to make sure there's nothing else that I haven't, you know, forgotten or something.
And there's often a good little whammy buried in there. By the way, if you do it this way, you know, this causes problems.
Sometimes. And it's sometimes I read it and I'm like, oh yeah, I totally forgot about that, you know? And so people have sometimes the weirdest combinations of features that they've thrown together. And there's no way the SQL team could have possibly test that many combinations. So it's always good to read those remarks and see if there's anything that stands out that might be specific to your environment.
Early in your conversation, we were talking about the, you know, the dropping of indexes and the changing of those things around.
Pop the stack. And I said there were three things that I did and I never got back to them.
You did one.
I know I did one. So removing the dead weight was number one.
Yeah.
Number two is to look at the health of the remaining indexes, because most people go straight for fragmentation and they think fragmentation is the root of all evil and is the problem, you know, that's across their database, right? I mean, it's very easy to find, and that's the good news, but it's not always the only problem or the biggest problem. So first thing I do is get rid of the dead weight. Then I look for fragmentation and the health of the existing indexes by using DMDB index physical stats. Mm-hmm. And then once I've kind of got a good maintenance plan together and I've got a stable environment, then I'll start slowly and iteratively adding indexes. And for that, I can use, in some cases, the missing index DMVs. They're good. They're not perfect, but they are good and they can give you some insights if you have an index that has a huge, what we call user impact. And if people are going, oh, how do I determine the user impact? You can do a search for the missing index DMVs. There's a blog post by a gentleman named Bart Duncan. I always tell people to search for Bart Duncan missing, but he's fine. but if they look for Bart Duncan missing, they can get to his blog post. There's also a SQL Serverpedia post that has missing index details and some really good queries. I believe Brent wrote that one. So there's definitely some great resources. to get some insight into which missing indexes have the highest impact. Now, right. I'm still not even going to recommend that they just blindly create these and randomly create these, right. but at least if they choose the one or two that have, you know, sometimes user impacts in the millions, tens of millions, it's kind of screaming that this index is a good idea.
Yeah.
So those would be things that I would do. And then from there, there's still a lot more that I would do. But as far as my quick and dirty, what am I going to look for? Drop the dead weights. Check the health, add anything that's screaming at you to be right. created. And then in and of itself, you might solve a fair portion of your
yeah,
query
problem.
It's
like a Pareto's law moment there. You've done a 20% effort that's going to give you 80% of the results.
Which then knocks on to reduced IO and reduced memory usage
a lot
and
of
so
that
on
stuff follows
and so on
from
and
there.
So on. Yep.
It, absolutely.
It really does begin with the query.
It depends.
Good answer. Nice one. You know, we didn't talk about the test environment. How do I test these things effectively? How do I get a set of data to actually run these queries and see if it makes a difference?
Well, if...
Without using production.
Yeah. See, now, if I had my dream test environment, mm-hmm. I would say take exactly the same hardware as your production environment, right. buy a copy, right? Take a backup of your production environment, restore it to your test environment, which of course has also tested your backup restore strategy. Yes. So it's not a bad secondary there. And then on that complete copy of your production environment, you can do things like trace analysis. You can add indexes, see what kind of impact they have. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can
but
do.
But we're turning on a profiler in the production environment to capture a workload set?
In a lot of cases, yes.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people freak out and they say profiler is evil and very expensive. And it does add overhead.
It exerts some load, but if you're at that close to the line, you've already got problems.
Yeah, it definitely puts some load on your server, but you can... cut that back. Like, you don't want to take any events in Profiler that are really internal events. Like, if you say, I want to analyze locks,
right.
you are just asking,
you're asking
for a world of pain.
And,
yeah.
and in order to create a simulated load, you don't need that. You just need query completions, right?
Yeah. So SQL statement, sometimes people get statement starting, statement completion. Sometimes
right.
they get batch starting, batch completion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, depending on what you want to analyze and what level you want to analyze, statement completion is really about all you're going to need. But
right.
there is a SQL tuning template.
Yeah.
And that's probably the best one to use because it also has a relatively reasonable small number of columns. And the columns are the attributes you're tracking about the events.
Right.
I usually add CPU and reads and well, so they've got reads, writes, duration, and so I like CPU, or maybe I've just added some of those reads, writes. I know they've got duration. They might not have reads, writes, and CPU.
Right.
In fact, I think those are the ones that I tend to add.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to go look to remember it off the top of my head.
But in terms of creating a workload for this test environment to actually run against to see what the different indexes would do, there's a template for that as well.
It's really the tuning template,
right? So use a tuning template, capture a load of an hour's run, 2 hours run.
That's a big, it depends as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on what you're trying to tune. It depends on what you're trying to analyze. If
right.
you're just trying to analyze a performance problem that tends to happen in the afternoons, you could grab a workload that's like 1 to 4 p.m.
Right.
You could even, I've done this before, create jobs that start the trace at 1 p.m., stop the trace at 4 p.m., and do that, let's say, every day for a week. Then you could take that workload, which is essentially 5 days of those
the
3 hours.
The worst case workload.
Exactly. And then you could tune that.
Mm-hmm.
You could run things like DTA or the old ITW, depending on the version that you're on, but DTA is good.
DTA?
The database engine tuning advisor, which
right.
technically would be DETA, but nobody uses the E.
Right.
So, but database tuning advisor. Now, it's again, not perfect. It is free. You gotta
yeah.
love free. And it can give you some insight. My biggest problem with tools in general, and I've done a couple posts, Paul's done a couple of posts on tools and trusting the tools and believing just blindly what the tools tell you because there are faults in every single tool we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes Management Studio is at great fault in some of the things it does. But
I don't like it when the tools lie to you. That's
no,
always scary.
No, but the long story short on this is at least DTA can give you some insight into which tables have the biggest impact on that workload and where it thinks indexes should be created. And maybe you're not going to go and create all of their indexes, but it'll give you some insight into, again, where you should look and what indexes and which columns are the most likely to be in those indexes. And then
right.
maybe slowly and iteratively, you can add one or two of those indexes and see what the impact is both in your test environment and or in production. Right. But, you know, you don't want to just take the 67 indexes it tells you to create, throw all of them into production. Some things might be faster, some things might be slower, and heck, if you're going to know which is
Well, and you've created a Gordian knot, you can't unravel where the problem is at that point.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, yes, I like the tools and they are helpful, but ultimately it's going to take a little bit of you know, common sense sometimes, just taking your gut and your feeling with it and saying, okay, yeah, this looks right. This seems like the table we have the biggest problems with. This is what the missing index DMVs are telling me is useful as well.
Yeah.
So you start to get this recurring theme. Now it's more likely that those indexes are useful.
Absolutely. And guys, before we wrap up here, Kira, I think you need to make your point one more time so that everybody remembers. This is the most important thing you need to know.
I always say auto shrink is just evil.
That's guys, awesome. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, you're totally welcome.
Thanks, Richard.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.